Well, Michael Bajant joins us live on Coast to Coast AM. Thank you, Michael Bajant, for joining us on a Labor Day weekend, although I suppose it's not a Labor Day weekend for you.
I have no idea what it is. You're just quite early.
Well, see, for us, it's a holiday, so thank you. And I'm glad that that you're going to be with us. Originally from New Zealand, of course, most people know Michael Bajant from Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and the other book that he co-wrote with Henry Lincoln and Richard Lee, The Messianic Legacy. But he's also the co-author of The Temples and the Lodge, Dead Sea Scrolls, Deception. What, about 15 other books? Am I in the ballpark, 20 other books?
Well, if you include a couple that came out in Germany, there's 14 so far.
Okay, very good. And I thought of you today with this story that was in CNN, and I'll get back to that in just a second, about the wall. But when we're talking about Holy Blood, Holy Grail, can't help but ask you, because of what a big impact that book has had, and I think it was an entertaining book to read, and it had some really great, you know, pot-stirring information in there that that you are famous for. Is there anything about Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and the effect that it's had that you have any regrets about? Is there anything that, like, where you look back and you think, well, people are taking this part too seriously, or they should really read the book?
Well, I think your last statement pertains really to every book I've written, because they're all packed with information. And, you know, some information is more crucial than other information. But my main attitude towards Holy Blood is one of astonishment. We wrote it, it appeared, it did very well, but it's just kept on selling, and whole new generations of younger people have discovered it. I'm constantly my mouth drops at the reach that it's had and the influence that it's had. But we didn't sort of sit down to write it. In a funny way, the story sort of told itself through us. We just happened to be there, and we just happened to pick it up. But there was a kind of it was like a gift that was given to us, and whether we did it well or badly is you know, our problem. But the story was there, and it needed to be told.
Well, I think you did it very well. I think if I could offer an observation, it's as an early reader of the book, I thought sometimes what I get frustrated with is that there was a lot of really good speculation in Holy Blood, Holy Grail. You guys were all putting pieces together, and you were saying, you know, what if, and it could be this, and boy, it sure looks like that. But over time, sometimes that has gotten eliminated to, it's a fact that this is exactly how it happened. And I don't think that does justice to your book.
So that's a real problem. I mean, we have tried in our books to be very clear when we've got facts and very clear when we're speculating, because people do confuse it. It's very easy to do. And, I mean, one of the problems with history, of course, is that history is basically speculation, because we weren't standing there at the event. We don't really know what happened. And one of the problems with history is that a kind of consensus comes together, and people agree that this is the way it was. And if new information comes along, they fight tooth and nail to keep that information excluded, because people have too much of their career or too much ego or whatever involved with their particular reconstruction. And what I try to do, what my colleagues and I tried to do, is simply look at all the data and decide whether the existing hypothesis or the existing reconstruction, whatever you want to call it, matches or stands up. And in many cases, we found that it didn't, and that we had to try and think of a way of revising it to take account of this data. But basically, I'm in the business of asking questions.
Right.
You know, my feeling is that if you ask questions, you already have an inkling that there's something askew. And for me, the posing of questions is one of the most important things we can do as human beings.
And it's what you do so well. And as I said, you're as much of a pot stirrer as you are, a great author. You propose these things and you push readers to think outside of whatever their comfort zone might have been. I just think it's interesting that Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, has created its own kind of new orthodoxy where people are convinced, 100% convinced that this is now the new set of facts. And I think, gosh, that wasn't the cool part of the book. The cool part of the book was, what if? And look, what if we look at it from this point of view? Instead, it's become something now which some people are almost incorporating into kind of new age religious orthodoxy. You know what I'm saying?
People love certainty. And unfortunately, the posing of hypotheses and questions is rather open-ended, and so they tend to chop that open end off or block it up with a lump of concrete and decide that that's all they need to know and it's true. It's a constant danger, and that's where our education systems should be teaching us the whole point of asking questions, posing hypotheses, testing the hypotheses. That's the way we progress.
I can't help but think, as somebody who's studied this a little bit myself, that there weren't, if some of the New Testament writers, just to use an example, were with us today and they saw how some of what they wrote in a letter, a fragment of a letter that might have been copied 15 times before it ended up in the Bible, that what they might say about how what they wrote has become interpreted and set, to use your term in that same way, in stone, when they were writing something just to try to encourage and do whatever, and it kind of gets twisted around. In a way, you're kind of, at least from where I sit, it seems like that's sort of happening even in your lifetime, as people are taking Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and making it part of a new set of in-stone religious beliefs. And I think, gosh, it's so interesting to see that happen in real time.
If I was younger, perhaps I could do a PhD on that.
Yeah, very good. Well, and you could do a PhD. You certainly have the educational background for it. And Michael Bagent, now the author of Racing Toward Armageddon, The Three Great Religions and the Plot to End the World. In this case, I would say you're doing less speculation than you're doing in other books. In fact, I think in Racing Toward Armageddon, you are fairly well seated within kind of a good journalistic zone of verifiable information.
Well, I was sort of running on outrage with this one because there was just events happening in the world that weren't seem to be picked up by mainstream media, or if they were, it was picked up, noted, dismissed. And I ran into the story in the early 1990s, and I quite often tried to get journalists interested in pursuing it because I was working on other projects, but this thing just really burned away at me. I just couldn't get any of them interested, and so in the end, I decided, well, I better write it myself.
So what were you saying to journalists? What were you saying to them in the early 90s? What was getting to you back then that you were saying you really should write about this story? What was the story that you saw back
the
then?
The red heifer.
Yeah, that is sort of at the nexus of a lot of this, isn't it?
I mean, the story of the red heifer is just the most outrageous and bizarre event. The fact that they're trying to breed a red heifer to produce what is the most efficacious purifying medium known to Judaism. Once they've got this, they slaughter the heifer, they burn it, they mix it with spring water. They can then storm the temple in Jerusalem, throwing this water before them and thus purifying the ground on which they stand. They can invade the temple area, destroy the Muslim mosques, and start rebuilding the temple. Now, at that point, the mainstream media would probably get involved and understand that something weird had just happened, and the implications don't even bear thinking about.
But in this case, when you say they, in your account, you mean sort of extreme Orthodox Jews who are anxious to tear down the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. They want to tear down, they want to take the mosque off there, rebuild the temple, and that the part of the they includes extreme, it would seem, fundamentalist Christians that are trying to raise the perfect red heifer to give it to them for them to slaughter so that they will go in and they will start what would certainly be a holy war.
And it gets worse, because when the temple is rebuilt, the Jewish fundamentalists, many of whom I would call extremists, say that the Messiah is going to appear. The Christian fundamentalists, many of whom I would also call extremists, believe that when the temple is built, also that the Messiah will return. But the two messiahs are completely different people. The Christian fundamentalists think that their Messiah is going to convert all the Jews to Christianity. And it gets even worse than that, because the Islamic groups have exactly the same idea. Their Messiah, the Mahdi, is going to return, come to Jerusalem with Jesus, oddly enough, and convert the whole world to Islam, with the exception of the Jews, of course, who they're going to slaughter without mercy. So we've suddenly got these three Abrahamic religions, of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all with this fundamentalist extremist core, which is gaining the levers of power within the religions and having a lot of influence, all believing that there's going to be an end of the world with the return of the Messiah, and it's all going to be based in Jerusalem. One can only say, poor Jerusalem, what did it ever do to deserve this?
Well, and the Red Heifer Project, on the face of it, I remember seeing news stories at the time about it, and it seemed a little more innocuous when it was originally presented in the story that I saw, that it was about having, well, you know, it wasn't quite a kumbaya moment, but it sort of seemed like it a little bit, where here were these Christians in, was it Mississippi? Is that where the farmer's from that was raising?
Yeah, Mississippi and Louisiana originally,
right.
Yes.
And they were trying to raise the red heifer, the perfect red heifer. Explain what the heifer has to be like, if you would.
Well, it has to be red, and after 3 years, it's not allowed to have any imperfection. And in fact, in the mid-90s, they did produce a red heifer. By this stage, the breeding program had moved to Israel, and they produced one who they named Melody. After a couple of years, in fact, some imperfections arose, so Melody obviously wasn't any good. But the program's continued, but it's gone very quiet. I think because of various bits and pieces of publicity over the years, especially in Israel, that they realize that a lot of people are very worried about it. I mean, some Israeli journalists were calling for the slaughter of all the red heifers because they could see it was only going to cause trouble. So they're doing it a bit more clandestinely. And also, of course, the accord between the Christian fundamentalists and the Jewish fundamentalists has more or less broken down, because one of the major Christian breeders, Reverend Clyde Lott, was suddenly discovered to be proclaiming to his Christian audience that he was spreading the word of the gospel in Israel. And of course, the fundamentalist Jewish rabbis he was dealing with thought that was anathema.
Right.
And it basically fell to pieces, because this is the problem. The Israelis, the Israeli fundamentalists are accepting money from Christian fundamentalists to sponsor a lot of their programs, but they're ignoring the fact that the Christians think that all of Israel, all of the Jews, will be converted to Christianity, which, of course, is just not on the radar of the fundamentalist Jews behind this. And so there is a real problem there, which both sides tend to play down, and they just quietly don't talk about certain aspects.
Well, that's why that story at the time, when I originally saw it in the media, seemed to indicate, well, isn't this nice? They're working together and they're trying to, but really underneath it, the undercurrent of these fundamentalist extremists trying to come up with the perfect red heifer to give to the other fundamentalist Jews so that they could create this march on the Dome of the Rock. There was a darkness to this. It was about actually bringing about the destruction of the world as we know it. And that brings us back to what the Muslim expectation is, because You mentioned it briefly, but it might have confused people when you said the Mahdi, the salvific force at the end of the world for radical Islam, would come back with Jesus. So explain that, because that would be, for some people, they would be thinking, oh, see, now we can all get together on the Jesus thing.
Well, Jesus is one of the holy figures in the Quran. But the Muslims, of course, don't believe that Jesus is in any way divine, but they still revere him as a prophet. But the Mahdi, who's the Messiah figure in Islam, who fights against the Dajjal, which is the Antichrist figure in Islam, the Mahdi, after this huge battle, which pretty much equates with the Christian idea of Armageddon, will come back to Jerusalem. And there's a very early Muslim story, a hadith from about the 9th century, where the Mahdi says to Jesus, you know, preach to all the people. And Jesus says nothing but pushes the Mahdi forward so that he can preach. And what that's saying is that the Mahdi is actually more important than Jesus.
We often hear about the vision of radical Islam to convert the world to all of the Muslim belief, to bring us into the Muslim fold, and we see that in the jihadic activities of Al-Qaeda and others. Certainly 9/11 seemed part of that, the idea that they're going to create a holy war and overcome the forces that are against Islam. That is a this worldly thing, but it's this otherworldly aspect of Armageddon, which is really, I think, the part that's terrifying. The belief that if there could be a nuclear holocaust in some people's minds, that will be a good thing. And that's kind of where we'll leave it here, if you would. We'll come back with Michael Bajant, Racing Toward Armageddon, The Three Great Religions and the Plot to End the World. And I want to tie into that coming up this story that appeared in the last 24 hours about a mysterious wall in Jerusalem. And mysterious for a couple of reasons. All of them very cool and relevant to what we're talking about. Again, it's not just Christianity, it's not just Judaism, it's not just Islam we're talking about, but rather the extreme versions of these. And we'll talk more about how many of them are kind of working together to create this Armageddon and what Armageddon would look like. We'll start with the Muslim Armageddon. What is it about this particular valley of Megiddo, and why and how will this battle take place? We'll give you descriptions of that, and really looking forward to this interview. We've got to stop this from happening, because some people insist that it should happen, and tomorrow is too late. We'll get to that coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Michael Bajant, who's probably best known for being the co-author of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, but who's been writing now for decades and focused on the same thing, alternative views of religious history, different ways of sort of understanding the same news stories that we're all experiencing, like Racing Toward Armageddon. And in this case, we're talking about extreme Islam, extreme Judaism, and extreme Christianity. We're probably most familiar with fundamentalist Christianity, even extreme fundamentalist Christianity in this country. Talk more about what extreme Judaism looks like, as you understand it, and extreme Islam.
Well, Judaism, first thing we have to say really is that it doesn't have a tradition of a Battle of Armageddon, whereas Christianity and Islam do have this tradition of a great battle. But nevertheless, it's hard to see how fundamentalist Judaism could fulfill its aims without considerable fighting. Basically, they want a theocracy, that is, a state where the only laws are the laws as written down in the Bible. And they want that in Israel. They want to get rid of the Muslim structures on the Temple Mount. They want to rebuild the temple. And their vision is that Jerusalem will be the spiritual capital of the world, and that the Jewish nation will in a sense, be the conduit for the redemption of the world, that it will be the most spiritual nation around, and through the Jewish nation, the rest of the world will be led towards spirituality. So to that extent, in a sense, it wants to see the whole world as Judaic. Islam is rather more violent, but it has the same aim. It wants to set up a worldwide caliphate run from Jerusalem, and it wants to convert the entire world to Islam. It wants to take over all the technology invented by the West. Because one of the things the Muslim fundamentalists can't understand is that if they're the chosen of God, why is it that they're more or less irrelevant in the modern world? Why haven't they got the technology? Why haven't they got the power? And this conundrum seems insoluble to them. Because, of course, the reason they haven't got those things is because they don't have the freedom of thought, the freedom of research, the freedom of expression, which has produced all the technology that we enjoy in the West. But they think that it just should be given to them by right.
And yet a lot of the fundamentalist Christian beliefs in a coming battle for in Armageddon or in Megiddo, in this valley of Megiddo, a lot of those are Judaic beliefs reinterpreted through the New Testament lens.
What's happened is that it's basically all down to the book of Revelation, which John wrote in the island of Patmos while he was in exile there. And it's incredibly symbolic, and one could argue, and many do, and I happen to think they're probably closer to the truth, that the point of Revelation is a symbolic expression of internal moral battles. But if we take it at face value, as the fundamentalists do, and see it as a prediction of the future, one thing becomes very clear, and that is that it's drawing from all the Old Testament texts, particularly from Daniel, from Ezekiel, the kind of symbolism, the creatures or the monsters with multiple wings and multiple heads can all be found in the Old Testament. So John was obviously, even though a Christian, was obviously well-versed in Jewish traditions. He was probably a convert, I should say, because he also expected that his audience would understand a lot of quite subtle allusions that he makes during the course of the book. And you would only understand these if you'd been raised in an apocalyptic and messianic Jewish context.
Right.
The sort of context, for example, that we find with the Dead Sea Scrolls, which there's certain parallels between, say, the War Scroll and the Book of Revelation. And I think it's pretty clear that John at least knew of the Messianic Dead Sea Scroll literature, probably had read it.
Well, and that the symbolism on which he drew was based around the idea of an uprising against Rome. He uses the Babylonian metaphor, but as you go into the book in great detail in Racing Toward Armageddon, you know it's pretty easy to sort of track a lot of where John was coming from. But what's less certain is how it is that this is being interpreted for modern times. We can see the Judaic roots of the symbolism. We can see the Old Testament, the Christian Old Testament scripture references, and how they get slightly rephrased. But what we don't always see are two things. We don't see whether or not this was projected forward into the future, which some people believe this was all about predicting events here in the new millennium. But then also whether or not John was influenced by, and I thought this particular part of what you wrote was really interesting, was about Pompeii. And how much about the events of the explosion of Mount Vesuvius influenced John of Patmos? Can you talk about both of those things?
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear that John wasn't predicting the far future. He was predicting what was going to happen tomorrow or next year. He actually states in Revelation that some of the witnesses of the Battle of Armageddon will be those who also witness the crucifixion of Jesus. So, and he was writing around about probably 95 AD during the last part of Domitian's reign. Now, to say that shows the limits of his predictions. For example, he had no concept of it being relevant to 1,000 or 2,000 years forward. And another thing that's interesting that you noted, that when you read through Revelation, there's certain aspects that are not only drawing from Old Testament texts, but there's some which seems to be drawing from contemporary events. It seems very likely that John was well aware of contemporary events. And this business with Pompeii is interesting because he's got a section in Revelation where he's talking about the destruction of Rome, but he talks about the sailors, the seafarers in their ships setting off, staying away from the land because the sea had fire pouring into it. And there was obviously, it's a description of an eruption. And it struck me that this is kind of sailors talk. It's the kind of thing you would hear if you went down to the wharves and chatted to eyewitnesses. And remember that Pompeii was, 79 AD, which is only about 10 or 15 years before John was writing. And so I think it would have been a very raw experience. And secondly, even the pagans at the time were pondering whether the destruction of Pompeii was because some way or another Pompeii had deserved the enmity of the gods and that the gods were wiping out Pompeii. And this idea of divine retribution being visited upon the city is precisely the idea that John has woven into Revelation. And I can't see it in any other way but that John was influenced by these events.
Well, and it was intriguing, actually, were some of the very specific language that John of Patmos uses in Revelation and how it seems to echo the historical record, the non-Christian historical record of the time of Pliny the Younger, right? He was the one that survived?
Yes. Pliny the Younger saw his uncle, who's called Pliny the Elder, die on the beaches of Pompeii. And there's a lovely description by Pliny where he talks of being on his ship, looking across the sea with all the pumice falling and the sea being blocked up. And it's very similar to a description in Revelation. And again, it's either sailor's talk or perhaps John had actually read Pliny's account. I mean, we obviously can't know his source. But the parallels are very striking and I think relevant.
Well, I want to read that coming up here in just a second. I think that's really important to point out because it is a recurring theme about watching the destruction of the world, as it were, from boats, watching it from offshore, and how that it seems very much like what we would say today if we were to use the term today, that John of Patmos was preaching with scripture in one hand and a newspaper in the other. He was doing what prophetic preachers do to this day, which is to make scripture relevant. And it's very much like what a lot of people are doing when they try to say that the news events of today help us understand the book of Revelation, and that at any time now, the sort of constellation of world events is going to come together and it's going to form the perfect cauldron in which the end times will begin. Some people believe that's already happened with the formation of the European Union. Can you address that, the idea of the European Union as being how the planets are lining up to create Armageddon?
Don't get me started on the European Union.
That's why you're here.
it's a travesty. Democracy has just about vanished here in Europe. The European Union is this great monster which is run by a junta, which is called a commission, which no one votes for. It's totally undemocratic, and yet most of our laws come from the source. But the European Union gets a particular mention in modern fundamentalist interpretations of Revelation, because in Revelation there's this great beast with 10 heads, and the idea is that each of the heads is one of the countries of the European Union, and this is going to be fighting for the Antichrist and against the forces of Jesus and God. Therefore, this monster is to be wiped out. Therefore, the European Union is to be wiped out. And there's a lot of speculation in fundamentalist literature about a war between the United States fielding the forces of God and the forces and Europe, which is being fielded or being led by the Antichrist. And once, many years ago, when I first got interested in this was the early 80s, actually, I went along to the U.S. military headquarters, who were serving in NATO, but it was the U.S. headquarters. And I talked to the head chaplain there, because I was worried that what would happen, was my question, if someone who believed this, believed there was going to be a battle against Europe, was serving in the U.S. forces in Europe, was there some kind of psychological problem that these people would perhaps come up with? And I had quite an interesting talk with the chaplain and his advisors, who claimed that they were journalists, but nothing really was resolved. But right at the end, just as I was leaving, he sort of quietly said to me, you know, the people we're really worried about in the forces is the Christian Broadcasting Network. And I thought that was very revealing, because this, as I'm sure most Americans know, is a hugely funded and hugely extended broadcasting network all through the world, which is pumping out this kind of information. And I felt that was a real admission, that they were worried about this prophecy of a war between America and Europe. And you see, it's like Armageddon. If you believe something, it affects your behavior. And the fear that's running through my book is how much of this belief could be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Something like 59% of Americans, according to a poll of 2004, believe that the Battle of Armageddon is coming, which means if the U.S. armed forces are representative, probably 59% of the armed forces believe this. If you're serving in the Middle East and you believe that the battles you're fighting are sort of preliminaries to the Battle of Armageddon, how is that going to affect your behavior? And the only answer we can say is, well, negatively, because at the end of the day, if you're sent by the politicians to fight in a country, you should be fighting for the values of your country, not for some religious or ideological purpose of that sort.
Well, okay, I think that's a really interesting thing to unpack, but I also, if you'll pardon me, I think in a way that's kind of a sidebar, because I think what's really crucial to point out is that the European, if we're talking about a battle between America and the European Union, that does not really seem to follow the prophecy of the Book of Revelation, that there are very specific things in the Book of Revelation that says are going to happen, and a battle between the United States and the EU doesn't seem to be it.
Well, no, I quite agree. But right. This is some of the speculation that's coming out. I mean, basically, the people who are going to be involved in Europe, according to the gamut of speculation, are the Muslims. The Muslims are going to invade and convert all of Europe to Islam. And so the European armies are going to help the Muslim Messiah in the attack against the Jews in Jerusalem. And by Jews, they also mean the United States. They sort of conflated the two. And it's useful to understand that the Muslim fundamentalist attitude is that every single Jew will be annihilated without mercy. And we find this in the charter, the 1988 charter of Hamas. And Hamas specifically states that they agree with this promise of Allah to wipe out the Jews prior to the taking of Jerusalem. So we can see that this is not just idle philosophical apocalyptic thought. This is real, and this is going to create piles of bodies. And
but
it's something that we need to avoid at all costs.
If we're talking about real, we have to point out that, in fact, the European Union is not a group of 10 countries that would seem to fit the Book of Revelation model. It's, in fact, as of last count, 27?
27, yeah, and there's a few more wanting to join.
And a few more wanting to join. So how could that in any way fulfill the prophecy of the 10-headed beast? If it said a 31-headed beast and we were still going toward that, that'd be one thing, but it doesn't seem to be going that way.
Yeah, well, the fundamentalists are not very good on history, which makes it easier for them to push out these particular concepts.
And so, again, we're talking about how all of this would take place in and around Jerusalem. And so I want to get into that, too, coming up, because I keep teasing the story, then we end up getting sidetracked and I never get back to it. And I want to talk about this wall that they discovered in Jerusalem recently and what I think that has to say about where we stand. And then if you could, I'd ask you, Michael Bajan, coming up in the next hour, to tell the narrative as you understand it from the Book of Revelation of what will happen. And then how that relates to 200 million Chinese that would be involved in this battle. That is a popular figure, and that is a popular country for people to say will actually be the invading horde, 200 million Chinese. Next, racing toward Armageddon, the three great religions and the plot to end the world. It's really the extreme ends of three groups who are all focusing on the same place, and how this intersection coming up could spell disaster in our lifetime, and what we need to do to stop it next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, Michael Bajan, author of Racing Toward Armageddon, I think it's fair to say that when it comes to an apocalyptic vision of the end of the world, the essential ingredient, or at least the same ingredient that's true for Christianity and for the vision in Judaism and the vision in Islam, is ambiguity. That you almost have to, you can't get too caught up in the details of the prophecy, because that's where, when the rubber hits the road, that's where it kind of breaks down a little bit, if we get too specific. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, I agree entirely. I would just add that it also relies on the audience not having a very good knowledge of the particular texts. They don't see that various statements are cherry-picked, that various assertions are made without much justification.
Well, as you know it, and you lay it out in Racing Toward Armageddon, what will happen? What are the events, beginning to end, as easily as you can explain it, that will come about according to some people's interpretation of the Book of Revelation?
Well, the story that John of Patmos gives us is that he had this vision. He was one Saturday, he suddenly heard a sudden blast of sound, and Jesus appeared with seven gold candlesticks, and out of Jesus' mouth was a sword. And this image comes from Isaiah, who says that the Savior of Israel, whose mouth is a sharp sword, it's the idea of the prophet and his cutting statements. And the seven gold candlesticks represented the seven primitive churches in Christianity. And what this does is show us that he's coming out of an ancient Middle Eastern, particularly Jewish, apocalyptic tradition, because this obsession with the number seven, we find it in the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Book of Jubilees. We find it in pre-Judaic Middle Eastern myth. It's very long established, the importance of seven, and this runs all through Revelation. And so we have God appearing with a great scroll, which is sealed with seven seals, and one by one these seals are broken, and various destructive events occur. And then we have seven angels with trumpets, and each blow the trumpet, and with each trumpet blast, a terrible disaster comes. And after the seventh blast, we have this beast appearing, this multi-headed, multi-horned beast. And then Jesus comes down with a sickle, and the idea is the sickle is used by Jesus to slaughter all unbelievers in a horrific description in Revelation, which describes the blood stretching, I think, knee height for about 200 miles. I mean, it's utter mayhem.
And unbelievers are unbelievers in God or unbelievers in Jesus as the Messiah?
Unbelievers as Jesus as the Messiah.
Okay, because that's key. Again, it points out to kind of that ultimate breaking point between when fundamentalist Christians are working with fundamentalist Jews, that one is not included in the vision of the other. All right, so and then from there, then what happens?
Well, there's two battles, really. There's firstly the Battle of Armageddon, and after the Battle of Armageddon, there's 1,000 years of peace where Jesus rules. And then there's a second huge battle, which, some people will argue that the two descriptions are the same battle, but if we just stick with the logic of Revelation, we have the second battle, and this is after Armageddon, the devil, Satan, is simply chained up, but he's released after 1,000 years.
And why is he released? Is there an explanation for why he's released?
I have no idea, and there's no explanation. And to me, it's rather like a cat playing with a mouse. I mean, if Jesus didn't like Satan, why didn't he deal with him the first time? I don't know. It's a conundrum.
Okay.
But after the second battle, which finally Satan is dealt with, slung into a pool of boiling oil, I think, or boiling something, lava,
pudding,
perhaps.
It's pudding.
Whatever. And then the New Jerusalem comes down from the skies miraculously, and peace reigns forever.
But it doesn't reign forever for everybody. It's only for a select group of Christians would then enjoy that. And the rest of the world, we're talking about a significant destruction of the rest of the world. Now, it gets interpreted to mean, then, though, that this all has to take place in Jerusalem, that it kind of all starts there. If Armageddon happened, if the beginning of Armageddon happened in Buenos Aires, or if it happened in, you know, in New Zealand, it wouldn't be the same. There's a very much of a focus on Jerusalem, and in fact, a specific focus on Megiddo, that really, in order for a prophecy to be fulfilled, it has to happen there. Is there a reason why, to this day, why it would happen in Megiddo, in this area that we refer to as the Battle of Armageddon?
Well, there's no reason that I know, but given that John was drawing upon old sources and history and Judaic myth and legend, there is a justification for it in that around about the 15th century BC, the Egyptian pharaoh Thutmose III invaded and had a battle at Megiddo and defeated the Canaanites who were in there and took the place over. And there's a lot of symbolism, I suppose one would say, between that battle and the battle which John is speaking about, this idea of it being crucial, destructive. It's the one big battle that seems to fit all the key elements of the story. And so I tell the story of the battle in my book because I think it's necessary to keep reminding ourselves that John was drawing from existing tradition.
And this is very important. Yet that the idea that there is nothing strategically, militarily important about this valley now doesn't keep some people who are in the fundamentalist extreme of predicting that, in fact, 200 million Chinese will march to Megiddo for this final battle. Why the Chinese, and how is it that we think they would actually come that far to have that battle there?
Well, that's one of the strange facts in Revelation, is that it talks, when the sixth angel blows his trumpet, in fact, there's this huge army from beyond the Euphrates River, and it's described as being twice 10,000 times 10,000 mounted men, which works out to 200 million. So to that extent, the fundamentalists who believe all this are true to the text. Whether the text is true is another point. But their logic is very strange. Their logic is beyond the Euphrates River is the East. The East is Oriental. The Chinese are Orientals. Therefore, this huge army will be Chinese. And the thought of 200 million Chinese driving all the way from China is just logistically absurd. It couldn't be done. I make the point in my book that if you had trucks driving at two abreast, the convoy would be 120,000 miles long, not counting the gas tankers.
Right.
So I suggest perhaps the Chinese could coil it up in the middle of China.
Right. Well, we would be able. We think we'd be able to tell that from Google Earth that they were amassing 200 million people and putting it in a truck convoy.
Yeah.
But then, who would the 200 million Chinese would they would be fighting with the European Union in that vision and fighting against the forces of whom? Who would they be fighting at Megiddo?
The forces of Jesus.
And so that would be presumably American forces or other, Christian-oriented nations that would come there to battle the Chinese at Megiddo for Jerusalem.
Yes.
And we think that the Chinese would come to get Jerusalem because what's the reason why the Chinese would come all that way to take Jerusalem?
I have no idea. Neither does Revelation. Neither does the fundamentalist. Only that the fundamentalist attitude is that they hate Jesus, they hate God, therefore they would naturally come because they are the forces of evil led by the Antichrist. It's not terribly logical, but then doesn't look for logic in these things.
Well, okay, and yet I feel it's interesting to point out maybe at this time that that there was a dig in Jerusalem recently where they found a kind of a miraculous wall outside of the old city of Jerusalem in what's called the City of David. They turned up a 3,700-year-old wall that was so large, it was 26 feet high, and it was made of boulders that are 4 to 5 tons. And archaeologists who work with the Israel Antiquities Authorities say that it's almost impossible to imagine how anybody could have built that wall back then. That modern wall builders using 4 or 5 ton boulders would have had to have used electrical equipment, power equipment, all sorts of, and it's a perfect wall at 26 feet high, and at this point they can only measure it 79 feet long, but they believe that it continues on. They only have that part exposed. And what's interesting about it is it's a wall that is protecting a spring that's still used to this day, by the way, but that this was a pre-monotheistic Israeli building. That this is from when the Canaanites occupied that part of the world. And what's so intriguing about that is to think of how long battles have been going on over what we think of as Jerusalem, and how much of Israel really has been at the intersection of human history, so much so that, you know, one group comes in, builds these amazing walls and structures to defend it. They lose it. Somebody else comes in and they build it. So, I mean, it really leads right up to where we are today. And it goes back 3,700 years, just one fight, one battle after another for Jerusalem. But I'm having a hard time imagining why anybody would come in from any other country other than the ones that are already there to fight for Jerusalem. I just don't see. I can't follow why anybody else would invade it, other than the traditional battles that go on between you know, Islam and Judaism in that heavily compacted area. Your thought on that, Michael?
Well, historically, there was every reason for people to come in because, of course, Israel was right between two very large empires for a lot of its history, the Egyptian Empire or the Egyptian state, and, of course, the empires of Mesopotamia and later of Greece and the various places in Turkey. And so because of this very important trade route, which was basically you couldn't sail to Afghanistan or to Iran, you had to go overland, I mean, from the Mediterranean, it gave it a lot of power. And one of the points of Megiddo was that there's a line of mountains which end at Haifa, and these mountains only really have one good path for traders' carts and chariots and so on, and that's really about a mile or so from Megiddo. So it dominated that path, and of course it would make it very wealthy because they'd take a particular customs due off goods right. going by. And that's the reason why there was so much fighting there, because there was always people wanting to, I mean, the Egyptians, for example, they took Israel at one stage because they wanted to secure their sort of northern approaches and dominate the trade routes, because they had a lot of trade with Lebanon, for example, for timber, and they also loved lapis lazuli, which was coming in from Afghanistan. But in modern times, what you say is perfectly correct. It's this importance of what they call the Levantine corridor is no longer there. And I think what we're seeing now is, in my opinion, a side issue to the real split in the Middle East, and that's the split between the Sunni and the Shiite Muslims. But I mean, that will skitter us off sideways.
No. I think that's natural, and I think that's where we're heading with that. Let me put this little wrap up, then a little epilogue on what we're talking about. That historically, a battle for Armageddon would have made sense in the minds of John of Patmos, the writer of Revelation, in the minds of apocalyptic thinkers for centuries. You could at least see how this pass, this crucial pass between the Mediterranean and Asia, that this area would have been kind of a hot spot. It was this sort of, you know, this is where a lot of armies or a lot of people would have been intersecting to each other all the time. But now we have planes and missiles, and it just doesn't make any sense that any army would go to that area. The only people that go there now, the only people who pass through the area now, are tourists to look at the area. Other than that, it has no crucial importance. And I just think that's actually fairly comforting news, at least to me, that there aren't, you know, massive armies of invading Muslim hordes and Israelis that are going to be meeting at that pass anytime soon. That if there's going to be a battle, it's going to be fought in the air, and it's going to be fought with missiles and horribly, perhaps even nuclear missiles. And that's a whole other thing, but it doesn't really need Megiddo anymore. But that brings us to what Michael just said, and I think this is incredibly important, and I hope you stick around for this, we think of the big battle, the big showdown, in our Western view, but there is another way of looking at the end of the world scenario from a Muslim standpoint, and it is the same kind of denominationalism that leads to wars. This time, though, between the Sunni and the Shia, and that this battle, this deep-seated animosity toward each other could end in an apocalyptic-like battle. And we'll talk about that coming up. Racing toward Armageddon, the three great religions and the plot to end the world. And then we'll get to your questions and comments coming up next hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, Michael Bajan's been researching the various extreme versions of the three great religions to look for the cracks coming up, where it won't just be a matter of people disagreeing on political issues, geopolitical issues, theo geopolitical issues, but they'll be taking military action about it, and this could lead to a kind of global destruction with the amount of warfare that's already going on in the world. I guess it's not too hard to imagine this could get ginned up to something bigger. And one of those things that we hear about but don't really always understand is the conflict between the Sunni and the Shia in Islam, and how this too could lead to a kind of Armageddon. Michael, what do we see as the likelihood of that?
Sorry?
What is the likelihood of that?
I think probably 100%. The problem is with Islam is when Muhammad died, he didn't designate a successor. And so on the one hand, we had his father-in-law claiming to be a successor, a caliph, which translates as successor. And we also had the husband of his daughter, Ali, who also claimed precedence. And the Shiites date themselves or take themselves really from Ali and his son Hussein, who was killed at the Battle of Karbala in 680. And this battle is still very real and very raw emotionally for the Shiites. But of course, the Sunnis take themselves from the caliphs. And there's absolutely no love lost between the two. I mean, if we look, for example, at the Saudi Arabian position, I mean, they're particularly hardliners, the Wahhabi Sunnis. And their attitude is that the Shiites are basically heretics, and the Shiites are worse than Christians or Jews. And in fact, as recently as 2002, one of the leading religious scholars in Saudi Arabia issued a fatwa allowing the killing of Shiites as heretics. I mean, this is a very deep split in Islam.
We can see this played out even in stories that we see coming out of Iraq, where there are often Muslim against Muslim attacks, and there is denominationalism, so to speak, between these groups that is sort of reminiscent of what happened in Europe in the 16th, you know, and 17th centuries, and leading up to the time of the creation of the United States, where there was this belief of, hey, let's sort of tamp down so that we stop having wars about, you know, amongst ourselves on in our religious beliefs. But this is actually accelerating in the Muslim world right now.
Well, the problem is that the Islamic world was more or less asleep until the 19th century under the Ottoman Empire. And it also had another problem in that Islam was founded with this apocalyptic fervor, in that they thought the world might have ended tomorrow or next week. And so there was no sense of planning for the future. They just wanted to convert as many people as fast as possible around the world. And this gave early Islam its drive, its conquest. Now, in the West, we've had the Renaissance, we've had the Enlightenment, the Scientific Revolution. We've also paid incredibly heavily in blood for our own freedoms. And even in the last century, the 20th century, the amount of people we have killed mutually is absolutely immense, 50 or 60 million in the Second World War alone. And so we have learned that toleration and compassion and understanding is actually a more viable option to sharing this planet. Whereas I think Islam has yet to really confront those particular issues. And it's this clash between Shiite and Sunni that I think is going to bring them to this confrontation. And at the moment, it's stalled. They've got various little side issues, for example, the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, which are being used in a sense to divert attention from the real issue, which is the Sunni-Shiite split.
And I think that's interesting that they sort of focus on something else, get their mind off ultimately what would come down to someday a showdown. And then there's also the Wahhabism right? The Saudi version of Islam, which is very small in comparison to Sunni and Shia. However, it's very well funded.
It is. I personally think it's very dangerous because it's taking a very hard line attitude towards dogma, whereas the world, I think we can safely say, needs a very flexible attitude towards dogma. I mean, one needs rules, one needs a tradition. It's like the keel of the ship that we're sailing. But to be utterly restricted to the truth of every single word in that tradition is going to lead us onto the rocks. And that pertains not only for Wahhabi Islam, but also pertains to Judaism and Christianity as well. A hardline dogmatic approach is a recipe for disaster, in my opinion.
Yeah, and then, so how do you see it? If you had to play out a scenario, just in nothing you'd ever be held to, but just kind of theoretically, how would this showdown happen in the Muslim world? Between whom? Who would be the players?
Well, let's look at absolutely contemporary events. Iran is clearly planning to produce atomic weapons, whatever they might say. And we need to ask, who is Iran's true enemy? Most people would answer, well, it's Israel. I would say, I don't think so. I think Iran's true enemy is Saudi Arabia. And I think one very likely possibility is a punch-up between Iran and Saudi. Because remember, some years ago, a lot of Iranian pilgrims took over part of the Grand Mosque in Mecca, and there was basically a gun battle which lasted for days before they killed them all.
And that would be the key part. That's the plum here is Mecca.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I think that's important to point out that this is, you know, this is the epicenter of Islam, and it chaps the perception in some people in Iran that it's controlled by somebody other than them.
Well, controlled by people who are illegitimate in their opinion.
Right. And so they might what? Then in this build-up, this sort of populist, Islamic extremist populist view of we're going to obliterate Israel, they might do that, make the weapons, but uh-oh, one of them went to Saudi Arabia instead, and that's how they would maybe create the scenario where they would invade?
Yeah, well, Saudi Arabia knows this very well, which is why there's various underground agreements between Saudi Arabia and Israel. This is the reality of the situation, whatever might be appearing in our news broadcasts. And there's another problem, too, in that in 1903 or 05, whenever it was that Ibn Saud took over Saudi Arabia, he made a deal with the Wahhabi authorities, and they ejected the sheriffs of Mecca, who were the Hashemites. And the Hashemites now are in Jordan and were in Iraq until, I think, 1958, they were all killed. But it shows that even within the Sunni world, the Saudis and the Wahhabis are not necessarily accepted as the legitimate protectors of Mecca. So there's the second split. I mean, the whole area is incredibly volatile. And once the cork was taken out of the bottle, which I'm absolutely certain it will be, then who knows what's going to happen, because they would tear themselves to pieces, I think.
And in a way, right now, focusing on their common enemy, as they present it, Israel, allows them all to stand shoulder to shoulder as long as they're focused toward destroying Israel. But if Israel were to be destroyed, and God forbid that should ever happen, but if it were to be destroyed, then it would leave them once more having to look at each other and have it to work that out. And then suddenly they would have no common enemy, perhaps, to be fighting against.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. This is what happened in the Crusades. The standing armies of the Crusades, the military orders and the kings of Jerusalem, understood this split within Islam very well, and they used it. But what ruined the Crusades, for example, was that a great group of people would come in from Europe who didn't understand these things, and they would just start killing and looting and stealing. And for that brief period of time, the Arab armies would all then join together and throw another Christian city into the sea. But so long as there was an understanding of the discrepancies, the splits, the enmities within Islam, they managed to survive. And the situation is exactly the same now.
I'm curious, too, as you say that, I reflect back on the images of Abu Ghraib and how that also was a unifying force. As long as the West keeps giving radical Islam fresh rallying points, the more we're going to be sort of helping them to solidify this animosity toward the West, that if we could just stop doing that, they might focus more on their own problems, and we could focus on fixing ours.
Yeah, it'd be a lot cheaper, too.
Yeah, I think so. So then that's one scenario, and I think you're getting an idea of what Michael Bajant is getting at in Racing Toward Armageddon, that within every one of these extreme versions of these popular religions, there are dark forces that don't care about how many people will die in order for them to be able to say later on, I told you so. And the firm belief that they would be the ones that would survive whatever this Holocaust is, it seems definitively militaristic and very likely nuclear. And we've touched on it a couple of times, but is there more to say about that, about where we stand right now with who has the nukes? And toward whom would they be pointed? And is there anything more about the Book of Revelation as it pertains to a nuclear holocaust?
Well, it obviously doesn't mention nuclear, but the destruction many people have interpreted as only being able to come from the nuclear. But I don't see the Book of Revelation as anything prophetic, but as I said earlier, if you do, and if you're serving in the Middle East, then you might create conditions that would bring it about. I mean, my entire book really is an argument for disengaging, because as you pointed out, the moment something occurs, say like Abu Ghraib or an event like that, it unifies these disparate forces and makes them stronger for that particular period of time. And as you also said, we are giving these unifying factors. So to that extent, we're falling into the trap of, pushing this agenda forward. And I think it's unbelievably dangerous. And I think that so long as this Armageddon ideology, if I can call it that, is seeping into our politics, we're in very uncharted territory, uncertain times, and who knows what we might create.
What can we do about it?
Well, the first thing is I figured I should write about it, because we need to question these things. So long as we're asking questions, we're aware that there's some kind of dissonance, some kind of problem. We should be teaching our children to ask questions and not filling their minds with ideology or dogmatic belief systems. I mean, it's one of the problems of the homeschooling in the States, or the madrasas in Islam, or the yeshivas in Judaism, which are all the ones which are hard line. They're training children in a very, very dogmatic manner who believe this vision of the future implicitly and are there to help it come about. And of course, it's all focused on Jerusalem, which is weird, particularly for the Muslims. I don't know what we can do about it, except, as I say in my book, we simply have to change our attitudes, because our religions have always had an inner and an outer aspect. And the inner aspect is one which has to do with the personal experience of things spiritual. And it's entering the silence, one could say. The outer aspect is one that's obsessed with the structures, with the dogmas, with the rules and the regulations. And it seems to me that those who are obsessed with the outer part of religion and think that that's all there is are the ones at the moment who are making the running. And so my plea really would be to people to pull back from the outer side of religion and aim more on the inner, the spirit, the truly spiritual. But of course, that's just my particular approach, and it may fall on deaf ears.
Well, I'll give you one thought. I don't know if it helps. And that's, I'm reminded of this as I was reading your book. And I believe in this, and I think it gets played out all the time, that the rise in fundamentalism in any religion will always be traced to the rise in complexity in the rest of society, that we crave the simplicity of fundamentalism. And the more complex things are, the more things seem kind of out of control, the more there seems not to be answers to problems, the more some people will turn to fundamentalism of whatever type to just make it seem like, aha, here's the solution. And so I think what we need a couple of breaks on are solutions. we need the more we can make the world seem simple and happy and an easy place to get through, the less there will be a need for some people to want to pull the levers of fundamentalism.
Yeah, I agree entirely.
And I think that that's where, unfortunately, that's also where people also feel this need to want to wipe the canvas and start again.
Yeah.
And that's if only we can just clear off all this other stuff, then we will be fine. And unfortunately, not everybody will agree on who it is that should survive the big canvas cleaning. And that's brings us right back to the conflict about the three religions that are racing toward Armageddon. Who do you think, before we get to phone calls here, got 30 seconds, who do you think would, what's the most likely, Christianity, Judaism, or Islam, to take one more dramatic step toward Armageddon? Michael?
I think it would be Islam, to be honest.
That's where we'll leave it for now. We'll come back. We'll get your questions, your comments. Racing toward Armageddon, Michael Bajan, co-author of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and so many other books. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. And if you missed that first hour discussion about the anatomy of evil with Dr. Michael Stone, I think you'd find that helpful, too, in light of what we're talking about. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. And so it is that we get to the calls, and there's a couple of pieces, little straggly pieces, that I had originally on my agenda to get to with Michael Bajan. Perhaps we'll be able to work those in throughout the phone calls here. We'll start with the person who's been hanging on the longest. Glenn is in Nash, Vegas on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Glenn.
No, Nashville.
No, I know, Glenn. I used to live there. We called it Nash Vegas when I lived there, baby. I'm sorry if you.
Okay.
It was a great joke then.
I was calling to refer to the sequence of events that happens that you seem to have some confusion on the church. When the church is raptured out, that causes an economic collapse, which brings on the one world government and the Antichrist. The Antichrist makes a peace treaty with Israel for 7 years. 3.5 years into that treaty, he breaks that treaty with Israel. And then that's when all hell breaks loose in the world and all kind of calamities are happening. And what happens at the end in the Battle of Armageddon is when the kings of the East and all come together to fight the Antichrist's armies that he has. And
right.
It's that time that Jesus comes back and ends the whole thing and places his foot on the Mount of Olives and declares 1,000 years of peace. And at the end of the 1,000 years of peace, the reason that there's a battle again is Satan is loosed for a season to tempt the ones that's been born during the 1,000 years of peace. And it's that army that Satan gathers together that is called the Battle of Gog and Magog.
Well, I love that interpretation, Glenn, and that is sort of the traditional interpretation.
That's a traditional
interpretation of it. Even your, and I'm so glad you brought up Gog and Magog, because again, you're having to interpret something to get it to kind of come out that way. Michael, can you talk about Gog and Magog and how the Bible seems to be very unclear about what this Gog and Magog thing is about?
Well, Gog and Magog are first mentioned in the Old Testament, and it's not quite clear whether Gog is a country and Magog the leader, or Gog the leader and Magog the country. But by the time it ends up in Revelation, the two leaders of Antichrist armies, and they've traditionally, by fundamentalists, been identified with Russia. And they are the people who, or the leaders of the army, which comes together at the second battle. I mean, after Armageddon, after the 1,000 years of peace, Satan is loosed again, as the caller just mentioned. And then there's this big army with Gog and Magog seen as leaders. So it's John, again, drawing from Old Testament traditions, garbling them slightly, using them for his own reasons. But there is one thing the caller mentioned, which I think we haven't touched on, and that's the fact that in Revelation, there's absolutely no mention of the rapture. And, of course, modern approaches to Revelation, the rapture, as the caller kindly mentioned, is integral. The rapture, Armageddon cannot be seen without the rapture. That is the taking up to heaven of all the people who are believers, so that they can sit up there in a kind of heavenly coliseum and watch the slaughter and mayhem down on earth.
And there isn't any mention of that, and yet that doesn't that also speak to kind of this larger issue that comes into interpreting these apocalyptic scenarios, is that it always happens to somebody else, and that somehow the good will survive, but each one of these world religions has a different view on who that good is, and that even Islam has adopted this extreme Islam version that you speak about in the book, Racing Toward Armageddon, that there's an extreme version of Islam that has sort of adapted a Christian scenario and merely moved some of the pieces around a little bit, kind of like how John of Patmos adopts a lot of the Hebrew scripture for the book of Revelation.
This is one of the extraordinary things when you look at the Islamic apocalyptic traditions. The modern version, which started coming out in the 1990s, draws incredibly heavily upon Christian tradition. It even quotes people like Jerry Falwell and Billy Graham. They are reading the book of Revelation and drawing from it. One's left with the conclusion that the fundamentalists of the three religions have more in common with each other than with their own moderate mainstream believers. It's quite an extraordinary situation. As though the Christians are feeding Islamic paranoia.
And I thought this was interesting, too, because it sort of speaks to where biblically, where a lot of the problems are with some of these interpretations. As the caller said, and in his perspective, and I appreciate Glenn and I are going to be different on this as Christians, but Glenn said, you know, Michael, you're leaving something out of the book of Revelation. And really what he had done was put it in, which is the rapture.
Yeah.
He said, you're leaving it out, but it's not in there. And so when you go through kind of when you went through the strict scenario as presented in Revelation, there was a reason why you skipped over it. And yet it's part of our psyche. It's part of the belief that the good won't suffer. Everybody else will, and that will be okay. And no wonder why some people are trying to force Armageddon to come about, because they are convinced that it will only benefit them. There's a pleasure principle involved. They're going to come out on top on this. And that's pretty scary, I think, for the rest of the world. Douglas is in San Francisco on Coast to Coast AM. Douglas?
Hey, always good to talk to you, Mr. Punnett, and it's an honor to speak with Mr. Beechin. Thank you so much for blessing us with your presence. And with your permission, Mr. Punnett, I want to ask certainly a few questions, but I just wanted to go over a bit on the Kings of the East, because as someone who would be identified as one of the 200 million Chinese hordes overrunning Jerusalem, there is a bit of a Protestant fundamentalist history in China that led to a tremendous apocalypse that was simultaneous to the American Civil War. In 1837, there was a man named Hong Xichuan who declared that he had ascended to heaven and talked with God and found out that he was Jesus Christ's younger brother, God's Chinese son. And he led the Taiping Rebellion at exactly the same time the Americans were fighting their civil war. And by the end of that rebellion, per Chinese textbooks, 175 million people died. And American mercenaries took part in that battle, but it was certainly something that has affected China to this point, where the Communist Party is just really down on any cults or religions forming. That's why they attack Falun Gong so vociferously.
And you had a question. You had a question for Michael?
Sure, you bet. I wonder why the Battle of Armageddon, which took place in 1918 between the German cavalry and Lawrence of Arabia's camelry, is so easily skipped over by so many of the fundamentalists in the Christian world and the rest of the Islamic world that saw this battle take place, even though it was historically recorded as a military operation. Nobody cites that as the beginning or end point, and also how the rapture doctrine affects us environmentally in terms of people just don't think that there's any point in taking care of nature since they're all going to rapture up.
All right, go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, this is one of the great problems with the fundamentalist position, that they can just loot and rape the earth and throw all the companies that are producing toxic waste of one sort or another and just dump it anywhere. They don't have to care, because when Jesus comes back, he'll make it all right. It's total abdication of any sort of human responsibility. And this is a side effect of this kind of belief system, which is utterly irresponsible. And as regards to the battles of Armageddon, there's been quite a few battles there. And
yeah.
I point to one particular one in 1260, when the Mongols, under a Christian leadership, had a huge punch-up just near Megiddo against the Egyptian Islamic forces. And, in fact, they were beaten. And so if you want a great army from the east being beaten at Armageddon, then that's probably the best one.
Well, and maybe then that's when the apocalypse did happen, and we're living in the 1,000 years after that.
Well, if this is peace, God help us all.
Chris is in Crowley, Texas, on Coast to Coast AM, first-time caller line for Michael Bajant. Go ahead, Chris.
Good morning, Ian. Good morning, Michael.
Hi.
What I would like to say is, first, I'd like to challenge your definition of fundamentalism. I consider myself a fundamentalist Christian, but I don't necessarily believe in millennialism, which is what you're talking about. I believe that Matthew...
But isn't that why he keeps using the word extremist, though, Chris? I mean, we're talking about fundamentalist extremism, right?
Well, he did say possibly extremism.
I don't know. I think we've said extremism like about a million times, Chris. I know I have.
What I actually said was fundamentalists, most of whom I consider to be extremists.
Right.
So I'm aware of the problem that you're raising. And it's quite a difficult one to quickly deal with without getting locked into a whole lot of explanations.
Yeah, well, that's fine. I mean, if that's how you want to define fundamentalism, I just wanted to make sure that we understood each other, because when I define fundamentalism, I guess more or less I would consider myself New Testament Christian rather than fundamentalist, whereas Revelation refers to the destruction of Rome rather than something in the future.
Well, I'm glad we can clear up how you view yourself on that, and I think that it's good to be a non-apocalyptic person, to not be trying to bring about the apocalypse. And I hope that there are people like you in every position of power in every world religion. Vince is in Livingston, Montana, on Coast to Coast AM. Vince, Michael Bajant. Go ahead.
Michael, I really find this fascinating. I've been researching these three religions for a good time now. And I appreciated the fact that you brought up the Battle of Horns between the Mamluks and the Mongols as being one possible outcome. I wanted to ask about Giuseppe Mazzini, the letter that he received from Albert Pike. Have you ever considered that in the conglomeration of this battle scenario, the Third World War that Albert Pike describes in the letter?
I think you better tell us about it. I'm not aware of it.
Go ahead, Vince.
Well, it's a letter that Pike wrote to Mazzini on August 15th of 1871. He went on to describe the First World War and the Second World War in great detail, and without getting too long, I'm prepared to read the Third World War scenario if you want me to.
Well, we probably don't have all that much time. There's so many people that want to get
paragraph.
On. So if it's just one brief paragraph, go ahead.
Okay, the Third World War must be fomented by taking advantage of the differences caused by the agentur of the Illuminati between the political Zionists and the leaders of the Islamic world. The war must be conducted in such a way that Islam and political Zionism mutually destroy each other. Meanwhile, the other nations, once more divided on the issue, will be constrained to fight to the point of complete physical, moral, spiritual, and economic exhaustion. We shall unleash the nihilists and the atheists, and we shall provide a formidable social cataclysm, which in all its horror will show clearly to the nations the effect of absolute atheism, origins of savagery, and the most bloody turmoil. Then everywhere the citizens, obliged to defend themselves against the world minority of revolutionaries, will exterminate those destroyers of civilization, and the multitude disillusioned with Christianity, whose deistic spirits will from that moment be without compass or direction, anxious for an ideal, but without knowing where to render its adoration, will receive the true light through the universal manifestation of the pure doctrine of Lucifer, brought
okay,
finally out to the public view.
Right, roughly here in this case, Pike is talking about Luciferianism as understood by Freemasonism, right? You're talking about Freemasonry?
Well, Albert Pike was the Grand Master of the Freemasons.
Right, so
yeah,
you're making the allegation that, right. That's very interesting. So, again, in a way, it falls in perfect. I mean, if that's true, and that's not just some apocryphal a paragraph that's attributed to Albert Pike, if he actually did write that, then he's following in the same footsteps that a lot of other people are. Just create a battle over there, have your enemies kill each other, and then you step in at the very end and go, aha, I'm here to save you all. Michael, we see that kind of played out a lot, don't we, in these scenarios?
Well, Pike was a general, wasn't he?
Civil War general, yes. But this would have been after, I think,
yeah,
after
I mean,
War.
In terms, I mean, if we just look at it in the cold light of day, I mean, he's a military man trying to devise a strategy which will destroy all that he sees as bad. It's going to be bloody, and it's quite a good strategy, I guess. And for someone who came out of a civil war, which was pretty bloody, I suppose he's used to slaughter. But it's horrifying.
It's sort of the same twisted belief that, again, assuming this is true, that Charles Manson had. And Manson espoused the belief that if he could create a race war, that, you know, that eventually somehow he would end up on the top of the power pyramid. If he could just get enough people to kill each other, then he would step in. TJ is in Arizona and Tucson on Coast to Coast AM for Michael Bajan. TJ?
Yes, sir. My comment is about the ten-headed beast rising out of the seas. There is one rising out of the seas as we speak. And it does have a false prophet decked in scarlet and is planning to move his seat to Jerusalem. And that beast is the United Nations, the North American Union, and the European Union, or two of the kingdoms. And the false prophet is the Roman Catholic Church.
These are some pretty... These are long-standing usual suspects, aren't they, TJ? I mean, people saying that the UN and Catholicism are, I mean, people have been saying that for centuries.
Well, I mean, there are 10 nations being, well, the United Nations is dividing the world up into 10 kingdoms. The Roman Catholic Church.
Where does it get the 10 kingdoms part? I don't know that part. Where do you see that?
Because it has a contract with the United Nations dividing the world into 10 kingdoms.
Where do you get that? How's that?
I've just seen documentations like on YouTube and videos and stuff.
Okay. And so these secret documents are already on YouTube?
I didn't say secret documents. Okay. I just started documentation on YouTube and other religious sites that expound this belief. And
Michael?
Part of the trouble with that is you can't test the ink and the handwriting to make sure that they're actually accurate or came from anybody who knows anything.
Well, the Roman Catholic Church is planning on moving his seat to Jerusalem. It's been doing that for the past 10 years.
Why do you say that? That just sounds nutty, TJ. Why would they leave the Vatican?
It might sound nutty, but the documentation is that they're going to do that.
Well, who's got the documents?
Well, I mean...
Some guy on YouTube?
Sir, let me ask you something. Sir, do you always question the people you agree with where they're getting documentation from? I'm just some guy.
Yeah, documents are really important, TJ, honestly. And when you say something like, because there's a lot of people who are Catholic, I know I have a lot of friends who are Catholic, who would tell you that they are not part of the Church of the Antichrist. And so I realize that for you, that's no big thing to toss that out. But I would say, in defense of intellectual integrity, you got to give me more than some guy on YouTube says that the Catholic Church is moving to Jerusalem. That's just me. You can believe whatever you want, but you got to give me more than just, you know, somebody had something on an internet site that said they're giving up Rome for Jerusalem. Let's come back. Last half hour, open line calls on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. And so back to the calls on Coast to Coast AM. We'll start with Alama Kunga, who's in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for Michael Bagent on Coast to Coast.
Hi, Ian. Hi, Michael. Michael, I'd like to know, do you know about the 14th century teaching that came out of India as a result of the Mughals coming in and bringing Islam? It went into Tibet. It's known as the Kala Chakra teaching. It's associated with Shambhala. This is another one of those scenarios where, you know, we're going to come in and save everybody. But according to that, the Shambhala myth talks about that it is, you know, Islam and the Christians and the Chinese are going to have big war. And when they set the world on fire, the kings that are in Shambhala, known as the Rigdon kings, will come down and basically be like Red Cross and humanitarians. To this day, the Dalai Lama teaches this to about 10,000 people, usually in India. It's a secret initiatory teaching. And I just want to know if you have heard of this, because, you know, this is a fourth world religion that deals with this prophecy of Armageddon.
I haven't heard of that before, I have to say, but I find it very interesting. But it doesn't surprise me. I think most religious traditions, one way or another, have a version of an apocalyptic tradition. I mean, Hinduism, for example, has this idea of massive renewals. I think it's every 23 or 25,000 years, the Yugas, where everything is destroyed and everything starts again. And there's possibly a bit of that tangled up with this, but that's very interesting. I'll take a look at it. Thank you for bringing it to my attention.
And yet, it may also not fit in the context of racing toward Armageddon, because nobody may be trying to make that happen right now. That it exists out there is sort of this belief that was discussed at one point. But you might have apocalyptic scenarios in non-religious traditions, where people in purely secular societies might have a vision of how the world was going to end. I just think most reasonable people don't want the world to end. They don't want to ruin things for their children and grandchildren. And that's the part that's sort of surprising about the forces that seem to be at work to be bringing about this apocalypse in our lifetime. Judy is in Houston, Texas, on Coast to Coast. Judy?
Yes, hi. Fascinating program. Also, I'm looking forward to your little slot that I think would be great on the web, which would be pundits.
Ah, well, thank you. People often get those words mixed up already. So.
Yeah, try to say it fast three times.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
I probably could, actually, but go
ahead. Well, I'll make this really fast. I know everybody's on the phone. I don't know if you or anyone else has seen linktv.org. they have shown some news clips from Al Jazeera television stating that the Saudi sheikhs are not going to accept dollars for payment for oil, that it'll only be gold will be the only acceptable form of payment. And do you think that'll escalate things? And also, you know, going to the gas stations, I go to shake hands with the clerk behind the counter. They're telling me it's against their religion to shake hands. And I'm just wondering if they're being checked out, you know, on behalf of Homeland Security, because those are, you know, kind of like local areas, you know, with gas tanks. So I'll just hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Michael, let's deal with the gold issue first. I hadn't heard about that. That's very interesting.
I haven't heard about that either, but I think I can imagine it being on the cards by some of the sheikhs. I mean, they're constantly talking of moving to the euro or some other currency, but the fact remains is that most of the Saudi investments are probably in US dollars anyway. So if they stop accepting dollars, they'll do their own investments a lot of harm. I would see it as agitation by some of the smaller players in the field, frankly.
And I'm not sure how practically that could even happen, because you'd have to move such massive amounts of gold physically. You'd need super tankers full of gold at some point to be able to pay for the oil that we're talking about, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean
that's just – I don't – the idea about, say, this Muslim man who, I'm assuming that's what she was talking about, who worked at a gas station who wouldn't shake her hand, that's not terribly uncommon. I know lots of Muslim, and I would call them friends, who have customs that are just different than mine, especially when it comes to the human body and who they will touch and why. And women in Islam touch other women. A woman Muslim behind the counter might have easily shook her hand, but it would not be appropriate for a man in some cases who was Muslim to shake her hand, correct?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of problems, I've been to the Middle East on many occasions, and I still get caught out on the things. And the countries differ. I mean, Egypt, for example, is quite liberal in many ways. Other countries are not so. It's cultural differences, and as human beings in this world, we have to respect other cultural differences. But when those cultural differences are put into the service of a political or spiritual ideology, then I think it becomes something quite different.
I have a friend who's a Catholic professor who has a brother-in-law who is Muslim. And his brother-in-law wants to keep holding hands with him. That's just very common for men to hold hands and walk around Saudi Arabia. And he says he just has the hardest time getting his mind around holding hands with his brother-in-law. Dave is in Cape Cod on Coast to Coast AM, where there are sharks nearby. Dave, have you heard about that? Near Chatham?
Oh, yeah. There's swordfish out there, too.
Well, I mean, there's a lurking great white that they're keeping an eye on out there. But you had a question for Michael Bajan?
Yes, I have. The Wahhabi sect is providing most of the Taliban, and at the rate the U.S. military is going killing off Taliban, is it likely the Wahhabi sect will concentrate more on converting Africa to Islam, because Africa had almost been totally converted to Islam before the 1700s when the Europeans, you know, used a lot of divide and conquer and conversion to Christianity to break it up?
Interesting thought. Michael?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting thought, and I think it's an accurate perspective, frankly. Certainly, there's a lot of Wahhabi-type evangelism going on in Africa, but of course there's a lot of Christian evangelism going on simultaneously, and we see it in Nigeria, for example, where the country's become completely split between the two factions.
Now, I can see the Wahhabi, again, if people are just tuning in, Wahhabi is a particular type of understanding of Islam. I could understand the Wahhabi connection to the Taliban. We certainly saw it in Osama bin Laden, who's Saudi, used funding for the Taliban. But is the Taliban traditionally linked to the Wahhabi point of view, or is it more traditionally linked to Iran?
No, the Taliban are hardline Sunni Wahhabi. It's one of the problems. Iran doesn't like the Taliban one bit. And not only that, Iran's got a huge drug problem from opium slipping across the border.
Sure.
There's absolutely no love lost between Iran and Afghanistan.
Thank you for clearing that up. John is in Bonnie Lake, Washington, on Coast to Coast. John?
Hi. I have a couple of comments and then a couple of questions. In the book of Revelation, in chapter 3, verse 10, it definitely tells us that God is going to spare some people. I won't say that it says the rapture, but it says, because they have kept the word of my patience, I will keep them from the hour of tribulation that shall come and try the whole earth. And so that is a reference to that. And also, the angels do put a mark of God in the forehead of people that are kept before the great outpouring of the tribulation hour. And
but stop right there. There's an interesting thing that you kind of have to skip over it, John, in order for it to make sense for a lot of folks. You're talking about the sparing of the 144,000.
I'm talking about putting the mark of God upon the forehead.
Right, I'm with you. It's the 144,000 that will be spared, and they will all be men.
Well, not necessarily, because,
it's in Revelation that they're all men and they're all virgins.
The virgins are people that are chaste virgins. These are people that have been renewed in their understanding of the Holy Ghost. And
John, hang on. I understand that you're putting that in there to make that make sense. But if we're just to read the actual text,
I'm not putting it in there, sir. It's in the, you have to read the whole Bible.
I do, John. Trust me. I read the whole Bible all the time.
Holy Ghost has to also be
John. Got to calm down a second because we're having a. And I don't want this to turn into a whole big thing, but it's very specific about it being men.
Turned it into a big thing,
John. It's very specific about it being men. And Michael, explain that to John because
Can I just say this, please? The people of Israel here, this is the 12 nations. God is going to take 12 tribes and put them on the earth in the last days.
I know that's what you believe.
Jew is one that is one inwardly. Do you understand? You don't have to be a Jew to be a part of this group. You just have to
I totally get that idea. Okay. And I understand that Christian viewpoint. And I've studied that Christian viewpoint for a very long time. But you are missing a fundamental part of that. And Michael, explain that about how it is going to be men, and that it isn't. They're really that's a very odd thought in a way that it's only going to be 144,000 and it will be men.
I know it's one of the trouble is a lot of people don't actually sit down and read Revelation without imposing some kind of belief system or interpretation on it. If you read Revelation straight. And just look at the words, just look at what it says. It states quite explicitly that the 144,000 will be virgins and will be men.
It says not spoiled by women. Is that what you're saying, virgins, but it just says not defiled by women? What's the line?
Yeah,
I can't remember.
Something. I'd have to go back to the original text to get the exact words for you.
But that's part's really key, because that means then that women won't be included, and it doesn't. 144,000 is a very small number. And is there a corresponding select group in the Muslim extremist view of that, of the Mahdi? Do they have the same belief in the Messiah that will only save but a small few?
No, not at all, and neither does the Jewish. End times thought. Basically, for the Muslims and the Jews, all members of the faith will be saved, well, as much as possible after the cataclysmic wars and so on.
Right.
It's only the Christian tradition through Revelation which has this restricted number.
John, first time caller in Tampa Bay on Coast to Coast AM. John?
Thanks, Ian. Hello, Michael.
Time.
I wanted to ask a question about the bones of that were found in Blanchefort Castle, but brought to Blanchefort Castle in the Pyrenees near Narbonne, and then in turn returned to that tomb that you wrote about in the book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, at to Argo, Arcadia or something like that, where the Catholic Church was blackmailed by the Knights Templars. And what I'm wondering is why you skipped around the question on whether or not those bones were the bones of Jesus Christ that they brought back from the First Crusade.
I think what you're relating to is, I'm not aware of any bones being found there, but I think from memory, I mean, it was 25 years ago. I think what we were probably saying was that there's no hard evidence such as bones or a birth certificate or death certificate or marriage certificate. I'm not aware of any bones being in a cave in the south of France. I know other people have written on that subject and speculated like that, but I never
but
have.
It wasn't.
My arguments have not put Jesus in the south of France. Mary, yes, but not Jesus.
Kevin is in Colorado Springs on Coast to Coast EM on a wild card line for Michael Bajan. Go ahead, Kevin.
Thank you, Ian. My question is, what can we do? How can we stop this? I feel like I personally am on a runaway train with no brakes. I feel that the religion is the drug of the people. You hear, I find it fascinating, a lot of the people that called tonight had to be right. Their way had to be right. And I just don't see how we can stop this unless we can convince people to respect each other's religion and not have to be right.
I want to ask you a question. I got to ask you a question. How can you talk about respect and talk about modeling respect, which I'm great with, and I think we all want to be right, so I'm not going to elevate myself above any caller. But then how can you say that and then use the term from Marx on religion being the opiate of the masses?
I don't mean that as an insult to anybody.
Okay, it sure sounds like one.
Honestly, Ian, think about all the wars that have been caused by religion.
Well, think about all the wars that have been caused by non-religious people. Wars satisfy goals, right?
Well, realistically, what we're talking about here is three of the world's great religions that are moving, and some of those people in those religions wanting to move to Armageddon.
Right. And well, there we are. That we are. Michael, you have a... Go ahead, Michael. I'm sorry, Kevin. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I think we can have broad solutions. I mean, I give the idea of the change of attitude and so on. But if we want something practical and something that can be done immediately, I think there's a need to strictly separate religion and politics. Keep them apart so they don't bleed into each other. That's point number one, I think, to preserve democracy and to preserve tolerance.
Well, and I think that religion, yes, has been the cause of wars, but it's also been abused in many cases to become the cause for war, when really the cause for war was more water, more oil, more gold, more land, more power, and religion was the wedge that was used to get to that, but it wasn't the cause of it. Not in every case, anyway. Michael Bajan, thank you so much for racing toward Armageddon and for this very sobering conversation. And I really encourage people that are vexed about what they're hearing, pick up the book, read it, work with it, make notes in the margin, and we'll, I'm sure, return to this conversation sometime in the future. And thank you so much for your time and getting up early for us, Michael. Deus te amat, and I do too.